Facebook is sharing your DMs with other companies, a Linux backdoor, Chase wants to track your spending, some insane misfits, and a lot more. Big 2 weeks here on Surveillance Report 173, where we're dedicated to keeping you private and secure with the latest news in the past week. I'm Henry from TechLore.
I am Nathan from The New Oil.
And as always, the best way to support this podcast is by consistently supporting it through Patreon, where you also get access to exclusive perks like our Q&A. You get access to exclusive episodes that include no segments like these, and you just get to go right into the episode. And it's also an extended version where we give more of our thoughts and our analysis and more of our discussions. Also some debates. And with that said, if you don't like Patreon, we're also on LibrePay. We also accept Monero, and we also accept any other ways you can give back, like leaving a comment, liking, and sharing. Before we get into the highlight story this week, which is Facebook sharing your DMs with other companies, just a quick little announcement that, again, we have a little bit of a weird situation with production because Nate did his own recording session last week, but I wasn't able to edit it on time. So we're actually combining some segments that Nate did last week with this week to give you the 2 weeks of news in the same episode.
For those who missed the memo, the episode number is now in the corner of the thumbnail. It is no longer in the title. We're trying to free up space for the title. YouTube wants titles that are under a certain character length, and that way they show up nicely on all the different apps and everything. So that's what we're trying to do there. If you look at the thumbnail, and we've made it a little bigger, a little more prominent, if you see something in the top right corner, that is the number. That means it's a full episode. If you don't see the number, then it's a Q&A. And on audio, we don't usually put thumbnails on the Q&A. I don't know if that's going to change or not, but if you don't see a thumbnail, Q&A. If you see a thumbnail, look in the top right corner. We'll probably repeat that a few times because, like I said, not everybody watches every episode, and we want to make sure that we're cluing you guys in and getting that information out there. But thank you guys for sticking with us. Again, we're changing up some stuff on the back end. I think we're done now, and we're just trying to smooth out the kinks. But there has been a learning curve, and I appreciate you guys' patience. Facebook has snooped on users' Snapchat traffic in a secret project, and actually also Netflix and some other people. So, quoting the first one, on Tuesday, a federal court in California released new documents discovered as part of the class action lawsuit between consumers and Meta. The newly released documents reveal how Meta tried to gain a competitive advantage over its competitors, including Snapchat and later Amazon and YouTube, by analyzing the network traffic of how its users were interacting with Meta's competitors. Given these apps' use of encryption, Facebook needed to develop special technology to get around it. One of the documents details Facebook's Project Ghostbusters, because, you know, Snapchat's little ghost icon. The project was part of the company's in-app action panel program, which used a technique for intercepting and decrypting encrypted traffic from the users of Snapchat, and then again later on YouTube and Amazon. The solution was to use Anovo, a VPN-like service that Facebook acquired in 2013, which I think we've mentioned more than once on this show, actually. In 2019, Facebook shut down Anovo after a TechCrunch investigation revealed that Facebook had been secretly paying teenagers to use Anovo so the company could access all of their web activity. So after Zuckerberg basically sent out an email saying, hey, we need more insight into how our users are using Snapchat, and the engineers came up with Project Ghostbuster, so-called kits that can be installed on iOS and Android that intercept traffic for specific subdomains, quote, allowing us to read what would otherwise be encrypted traffic so we can measure in-app usage. This is known as a man in the middle, or these days they're calling it person in the middle to be a little more gender neutral. So Facebook's then head of security engineering wrote in an email, quote, I can't think of a good argument for why this is okay. No security person is ever comfortable with this, no matter what consent we get from the general public. The general public just doesn't know how this stuff works. Quoting the article, by 2013, Netflix had begun entering into a series of, quote, Facebook extended API agreements, including a so-called inbox API agreement that allowed Netflix programmatic access to Facebook users' private message inboxes, in exchange for which Netflix would, quote, provide to Facebook a written report every 2 weeks that shows daily counts of recommendation sends and recipient clicks by interface, initiation surface, and or implementation variant, such as Facebook versus non-Facebook recommendation recipients. In August of 2013, Facebook provided Netflix with access to its so-called Titan API, a private API that allowed a whitelisted partner to access, among other things, Facebook users' messaging app and non-app friends. Where to even start with this story? Well, first of all, on the topic of Anovo VPN, let's go ahead and point out VPNs are a transfer of trust. And that is why here at Surveillance Report, the new oil, tech lore, we are fans of VPNs. We do think that they very often get overhyped, especially in their own marketing. By now, I think most of us, the veterans, know the tropes of, you know, it'll make you anonymous and hacker-proof and all these other lies that are not true at all. Even so, we do believe they have value. They can add a little bit of security. The DNS block list can be helpful for blocking some ads and trackers, some known malicious domains, so it's not perfect, but it does offer a little security. And of course, a little bit of privacy by kind of mixing your IP address with some other people. Again, definitely not the magic panacea that the marketing companies make it out to be, but we do believe there is a use case for it. However, this is why we recommend reputable VPNs like Mulvad, iVPN, Proton, Windscribe. These are companies that have a long history of caring about users, caring about their privacy. I mean, we weren't working together in 2013, but I remember the first time I heard about it, I was like, comes from Facebook. This is probably a honeypot and it's super sketchy. And I think it's important to remember for all the VPN haters out there, the VPN market is huge. Like, Inovo is definitely a honeypot. There's others that are probably honeypots. We've seen them come and go. That doesn't mean they're all garbage. There's certainly a lot of garbage out there that you have to wade through, but there are good ones. So what I'm trying to say is this is just a reminder. You are transferring trust. You are still trusting a company. Therefore, make sure they are a trustworthy company. I think for people just joining us, this is your reminder or maybe newsflash in case you didn't know. Facebook is a terrible company, full stop. You know, with most companies, I think we can at least find a redeeming quality. You may not like Apple, and there's plenty to not like about Apple, but they make good user-friendly software. They do have very secure devices. They are technically more private than someone like Google. And that's not me singing their praises. That's just an example. Google offers very secure software, offers very functional software. There's a reason everybody uses Gmail. Google search is kind of out on that one. But, you know, my point being, like, with every company, I think you can look at them and see redeeming qualities. I don't see a redeeming quality for Facebook to exist. I have not met anyone in the last 5 years who actually likes Facebook. Even their biggest fans admit that Marketplace is pretty much the only thing that's useful about them anymore. I don't know. They're a terrible company through and through. And this story just proves there's literally nothing. There's nothing that's too low for them. They will compromise your security. They will bend over backwards, jumping through flaming hoops to compromise your privacy, to spy on you more, to get more data about you. They're a terrible, terrible company. And for the veterans, this is, you know, preaching to the choir, but for anyone who found their way here, like, this is just the latest in a long string. There's a whole Wikipedia page of Facebook's privacy scandals and they're bad. This is not the first time they've been intercepting messages. They did it to Android devices back in 2016 with the Cambridge Analytica scandal. Which if you haven't heard of that, that's a whole thing. There's whole documentaries about it. They're a god awful company. So I really think you should avoid Facebook products at all possible opportunities. And unfortunately that won't stop them from collecting data on you anyways, despite what Zuckerberg says, shadow profiles are a thing. We know that. This is just the latest in a long line of things, but it's funny because I've even seen a few experts who are like, wow, I did not expect this from Facebook. Like, as crappy as they are, this is a new low even for them. I, on the other hand, was not even remotely surprised, probably because my opinion of them could not be any lower.
All right, and now data breaches. A yacht retailer, Marine Max, discloses data breach after a cyber attack. They're self-described as one of the world's largest recreational boat and yacht retailers. This breach took place in March, and they said that sensitive data wasn't stored in the compromised systems, but they later said that it did include personal information, which affected both customers and employees, but did not disclose the number of people impacted. The ransomware gang claims to have financial documents along with employee driver's licenses and passports. Don't know who here is using yachts, but if you do, be ready.
It says INC ransom threatens to leak 3 terabytes of NHS Scotland stolen data. For those outside the UK, NHS is the National Health Service. It's the public healthcare system. The threat actor published several sample documents with sensitive information about doctors and patients, including medical assessments, analysis results, and psychological reports. So that's kind of the relevant part of that. We will see if they carry through with this or not. So the Indian government's cloud was spilling citizens' personal data online for years. The Indian government has finally resolved a years-long cybersecurity issue that exposed reams of sensitive data about its citizens. A security researcher exclusively told TechCrunch that he found at least hundreds of documents containing citizens' personal information, including Aadhaar numbers, COVID-19 vaccination data, and passport details, spilling online for anyone to access. At fault was the Indian government's cloud service, dubbed S3WAAS, which is billed as a, quote, secure and scalable system for building and hosting Indian government websites. Found in 2022, the misconfiguration, quote, was exposing citizens' personal information stored on S3WAAS to the open internet. Because the private documents were inadvertently made public, search engines also indexed them, allowing anyone to actively search the internet for the sensitive private citizen data. So good job on closing that, although it's kind of disappointing that it took years.
Survey Llama data breach exposes information of 4.4 million users. So this is an online platform that rewards registered users for completing surveys. I've definitely used a few of those when I was younger. But in early February, Have I Been Pwned received information about a data breach impacting the service, which includes things like date of births, email addresses, IP addresses, full names, passwords, phone numbers, and physical addresses.
U.S. Cancer Center data breach exposes info of 827,000 patients. So City of Hope is a National Cancer Institute designated comprehensive cancer center providing treatment for cancer, diabetes, and other life-threatening diseases. The organization is headquartered in Duarte, California, and operates oncology clinics across the United States. The sensitive data that may have been exposed as a result includes full names, email address, phone number, date of birth, social security number, driver's license number, government ID, bank account number, credit card details, health insurance information, and medical records and history. City of Hope says there's no evidence of identity theft or fraud occurring due to this incident and clarifies that not every data type listed above was compromised for every patient, so the level of exposure varies per case. This is another incident that we know about because they filed paperwork with the Maine Attorney General's office, and they have implemented additional defenses to prevent similar incidents and are offering 2 years of free identity monitoring. And this is an update to last week. It says AT&T resets account passcodes after millions of customer records leaked online. So basically, last week we had a threat actor who said, hey, I have this AT&T data for sale for... I think they said it was like 70 million customers or something like that. And AT&T was like, well, that didn't come from us. And the threat actor was like, I don't care. I have it and I'm selling it. And so it seems what happened was the data set came from like a 2019 breach or maybe somewhere a little earlier than that. Basically, for whatever reason, it is now public and this person has published it. So AT&T finally admitted, well, they're still saying it didn't come from us, but it is AT&T customer data, and they have urged all of the affected customers to reset their passcodes in order to protect their accounts, because the passcodes were encrypted, but they're only 4 digits, so they're kind of easy to decrypt. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all there is on that one. So we officially know this was a legitimate leak of some kind. It is older data, but still, they have reset passcodes. With that, we'll launch into companies, and we have quite a few. We're going to start off with Google. First off, the government has ordered Google to unmask certain YouTube users, and critics say it's terrifying. This came from Forbes. Unfortunately, I cannot find a better outlet, a more direct source. So this comes from a case in Kentucky where undercover cops sought to identify the individual behind the online moniker Elon Musk WHM, who they suspect of buying Bitcoin for cash, potentially running afoul of money laundering laws and rules around unlicensed money transmitting. I'm going to imagine there's probably more to it than that, but that's what they wrote. In conversations with the user in early January, undercover agents sent links of YouTube tutorials for mapping via drones and augmented reality software, and then asked Google for information on who had viewed the videos, which collectively had been watched over 30,000 times. The court orders show the government telling Google to provide them the names, addresses, phone numbers, and user activity for all Google account users who accessed the videos between January 1st and January 8th, 2023. The government also wanted the IP addresses of non-Google account owners who viewed the videos. The court granted the order, and Google was told to keep the request secret until it was unsealed earlier this week. The court records do not show whether or not Google provided the data in this case. And then the article goes on to talk about how this is kind of a thing that's going on a lot, actually. So in another example involving an investigation in New Hampshire, the Portsmouth police received a threat from an unknown male that an explosive had been placed in a trash can in a public area. After the police searched the area, they learned they were being watched over a YouTube live stream camera associated with a local business. The federal investigators believe similar events have happened across the U.S. where bomb threats are made and cops watched via YouTube. They have asked Google to provide a list of accounts that viewed or interacted with 8 YouTube live streams and the associated identifying information during specific timeframes. Again, it's unclear whether Google provided the data.
JP Morgan Chase is about to let advertisers target customers based on their spending. Now, when I put this in here, Nate even said, well, weren't they already doing that? And I think a lot of people here already have that assumption with a lot of banks, especially because if you dig into the privacy opt-out, most of them say, can we use any of your data for marketing purposes and things like this? But it's nice to have these stories that you can send along with people, and it's more direct evidence of this type of information. It's a very quick story, but Chase is launching a new retail media platform that will allow brands to market directly to its 80 million customers that's using data on their spending habits. This is through the newly minted Chase Media Solutions. Businesses will be able to target users with personalized offers and provide incentives to customers like cashback. And they're branding this as something that's pro-consumer, because now consumers get matched with the deals they want, with the brands they use, or the brands they might want to use. And it's probably a lot more of that, which is brands they might want to use. So it'd be cool if there's a way to opt out. I didn't see anything in the article that goes into opt-outs or anything like that. But just be aware that this is where something like privacy.com is really nice, because then you can hide your transactions from your bank.
I'm going to be quick on this next story because I don't really feel like this is new. It's more like an evolution of an existing thing. The headline says Google's new AI search result promotes sites pushing malware and scams. So basically, earlier this month, Google began rolling out a feature called Google Search Generative Experience, or SGE, which provides AI-generated quick summaries for search queries, including recommendations for other sites to visit related to the query. As a Brave search user, I know Brave does this. Probably everybody's doing this right now. You know, AI is the big thing. However, an SEO consultant first spotted that SGE is recommending spammy and malicious sites within its responses, making it easier for users to fall for scams. You can read more data in the articles, but specifically, we've covered these stories before where malicious actors will go buy Google ads that will show up in search, and people will search for, you know, VLC or GIMP, or we've covered a story about Bitwarden. Like, people will search for these things and they see the first result, which are usually not very well marked as ads, because of course they don't want you, like, smart people will ignore the ads because they know it's an ad. So they don't want you to know that it's an ad. So it's not very clearly marked a lot of the time. So people will click on it because they go, oh, it's Bitwarden. It's bitwarden.org instead of .com, or it's bitwarden.io instead of .com. And people don't know that or don't realize it, and they click on it, and the next thing they know, they've got malware. Our next story comes from Telegram, whose new peer-to-peer SMS relay is an absolute privacy nightmare, and also just kind of sketchy. So Telegram has started offering some of its users free premium subscriptions in exchange for access to their phones for sending out login verification codes via SMS. The feature is potentially a privacy and spam nightmare, as participants will presumably be able to see the numbers that their phones are sending out codes to. Even though they're not supposed to, it says not allowed to, but let's be real. Even though they're not supposed to contact these numbers as per the terms of service, Telegram shouldn't provide random users with other users' phone numbers for whatever reason. With this policy, any Telegram user's phone numbers could potentially be shared with strangers, even if they haven't opted into the program themselves. So, for example, someone signing up for the first time might receive an OTP code from one of the phones who participates in the program, potentially leaking their phone number to the sender. In its P2PL terms of service, the company says the program, quote, may not be available to users in certain regions in accordance with current demand, economic factors, relevant regulatory restrictions, and local telecommunications infrastructure. This seems to indicate that some users protected by privacy laws such as GDPR or CCPA may not receive codes from numbers as part of the program. However, Telegram doesn't mention the fact that it's sharing phone numbers with third parties for the purpose of verification at all in its privacy policy or premium terms of service, indicating that its new P2PL program could violate its own privacy policy. People who join the program will get a free month of Telegram Premium, but could also face problems with their mobile service providers. It's likely that most carriers forbid subscribers from sending automated messages like this through their regular consumer accounts. This is probably why Telegram will only send up to 100 messages per month, but even then, participants could face being banned by their cellular service provider. Our next story comes from Nigeria, where a woman reviewed some tomato puree online and is now facing jail time. So I'm totally going to butcher this name, and I apologize. Chioma Okoli? Is a 39-year-old entrepreneur from Lagos, and she is being prosecuted and sued in civil court for allegedly breaching the country's cybercrime laws in a case that has gripped the West African nation and sparked protests by locals who believe she is being persecuted for exercising her right to free speech. Okoli is a small-scale importer of children's wear and told CNN on September 17th that she asked her 18,000 Facebook followers to share their opinions about a tomato puree that she bought in place of her usual brand, saying that she found it too sweet. The post was accompanied by a photo of an open can of Nagiko tomato mix, which is produced by local company Arisco Foods Limited, sparked varied reactions from commenters, one of whom replied, quote, "Stop spoiling my brother's product. If," and this is broken English, but "if you don't like it, use another one, then bring it to social media or call the customer service." Okoli responded, "Help me advise your brother to stop killing people with his product. Yesterday was my first time using, and it's pure sugar." And then a week later, on September 24th, she was arrested. In legal filings seen by CNN, the Nigeria police force alleged that Okoli used her Facebook account, quote, "with the intention of instigating people against Arisco Foods," adding in a statement on March 7th that it had, quote, "unearthed compelling evidence against her from its preliminary investigations." According to the police, Okoli was charged with, again, instigating Arisco Foods Limited, knowing that said information to be false under Section 24(1)(b) of Nigeria's Cybercrime Prohibition Act. If found guilty, she could face up to 3 years in jail or a fine of 7 million naira, which is about $5,000 USD, or both. Okoli is also being sued in a separate civil case brought by Arisco, which said in a statement issued on January 19th that it was defending its reputation after her comments, quote, "resulted in several suppliers deciding to dissociate themselves from us," unquote. The Lagos-based food company said that it also suffered the loss of multiple credit lines and had therefore filed a civil lawsuit against Okoli that sought 5 billion naira, more than $3 million USD, in damages. The case is due to be heard on May 20th. I guess this is also just the reminder that not everything needs to be online. Be careful what you post. Even if the company is in the wrong here and she was just exercising her free speech, like, even if she wins this lawsuit, like, this is going to be so disruptive. This is going to follow her everywhere she goes. Like, I guarantee you, if she could go back in time and take that post down, she would, and like not post it. So yeah, just remember that the internet is a very unforgiving place. Ask us how we know. Okay, our last company story is quick. Dashlane Authenticator is being discontinued. You are still able to use the main Dashlane app as an authenticator to protect logins stored in Dashlane with 2FA. We don't recommend Dashlane. I've talked to one of their developers. They do have some white papers. They do have some audits, but they're not source available. They collect way too much information, in my opinion, than they should. Just use Bitwarden. Bitwarden's better. I mean, it's the same thing. It's not a separate app, but like, if you want a password manager with 2FA stored in one, Bitwarden with a YubiKey, or, you know, if you still just want an authenticator, we'll talk about NT a little later. There's Aegis if you're on Android. Yeah, there's better choices than Dashlane. That'll bring us to research. We have a couple of interesting stories this week. The first one is a new Zenhammer memory attack that impacts AMD Zen CPUs. So again, this is one of those stories with technical details in the article. We're going to stick to the broad strokes here. Academic researchers developed Zenhammer, the first variant of the Rowhammer DRAM attack that works on CPUs based on the recent AMD Zen microarchitecture that map physical addresses on DDR4 and 5 memory chips. AMD Zen chips and DDR5 RAM modules were previously considered less vulnerable to Rowhammer, so the latest findings challenge this notion. We covered this in a surveillance report forever ago, But Rowhammer is a well-documented attack method that exploits a physical characteristic of modern DRAM, which is dynamic random access memory, to alter data by repeatedly accessing, or hammering, specific rows of memory cells through read-write operations to change bit values inside. By strategically inducing these bit flips in specific locations, an attacker could gain access to sensitive data, such as cryptographic keys, or escalate privileges. So right now, the options that AMD CPU users have to defend against this is to apply software patches and firmware updates. It's worth highlighting that these attacks are complex, and successful execution requires an attacker with a deep understanding of both software and hardware components. So, as with a lot of these research stories we cover, this is alarming. It's something you should have on your radar, but you don't need to freak out because, generally speaking, this is not something that any random script kiddie on the internet is going to be using, or, you know, every website is going to be using en masse. This is something that's going to be targeted by very well-resourced adversaries against very specific users. So don't panic. And our second research story says AI hallucinates software packages and devs download them, even if potentially poisoned with malware. Several big businesses have published source code that incorporates a software package previously hallucinated by generative AI. Not only that, but someone, having spotted this recurring hallucination, had turned that made-up dependency into a real one, which was subsequently downloaded and installed thousands of times by developers as a result of the AI's bad advice. If the package was laced with actual malware rather than being a benign test, the results could have been disastrous. One of the businesses fooled by AI into incorporating the package was Alibaba, and there were probably others too. These tools can definitely be helpful. It's just that you're placing a lot of trust in them, and you should not just blindly believe them. That's really the issue here.
And now we're going to head into politics. And the next two stories are actually somewhat positive. The next several stories are actually somewhat positive. So this is from CNN, and pretty much there's now going to be more AI safeguards incoming, including a right to refuse facial recognition scans at U.S. airports. So this week, every U.S. agency was ordered to appoint a chief AI officer, but that wasn't the only AI policy announced. By the end of the year, travelers should be able to refuse facial recognition scans at airport security screenings without fear it could delay or jeopardize their travel plans. Under the requirements taking effect on December 1st, agencies using AI tools will have to verify they do not endanger the rights and safety of the American people. In addition, they'll have to publish online a complete list of the AI systems it uses and their reasons for using them, along with a risk assessment of those systems. Not a bad start. I think that, like, that's a basic step one. I'm shocked that wasn't done in the first place, but it's great to see this finally happen. There's still a long ways to go, but I think it's a great start.
Department of Homeland Security is expected to stop buying access to your phone movements. So since 2018, agencies within the department, including Immigration and Customs Enforcement, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, and the Secret Service, have been buying access to commercially available data that revealed the movement patterns of devices, many inside the U.S. Commercially available phone data can be bought and searched without judicial oversight. Three people familiar with the matter said that DHS isn't expected to buy access to any more of this data, nor will the agency make any additional funding available to do so. The agency paused this practice after a 2023 watchdog report pending a recommendation that they draw up better privacy controls and policies. However, it seems the department instead appears to be winding down the use of the data entirely. So this is kind of unofficial, but it's still good news.
Another win. Kind of. Google is to destroy browsing data to settle consumer privacy lawsuit. So they're going to destroy billions of data records that are going to settle this lawsuit claiming that they secretly tracked the internet use of people who thought they were browsing privately through incognito mode. Google's paying no damages, but users may sue the company individually for damages. Users allege that Google Analytics, cookies, and apps let the Alphabet unit improperly track people who set Google Chrome browser to incognito mode and other browsers to private browsing mode. They said this turned Google into an unaccountable trove of information by letting it learn about their friends, favorite foods, hobbies, shopping habits, and the most intimate and potentially embarrassing things they hunt for online. Under the settlement, Google will update disclosures about what it collects in private browsing, a process that it has already begun. It will also let incognito users block third-party cookies for 5 years. So this is something we've talked about for a long time, that incognito mode is fairly restricted in what it can do. And on top of this, Google actually doesn't really stop any more of its tracking in those modes. At least they didn't used to. I'm not up to date if they're changing their policies around that due to this situation. But I mean, I guess this is a bare minimum. Something I'm upset about is that there are no damages that Google has to pay when Google's probably already profited off of all of that data collection. So it's probably not a huge deal that Google can delete that data when they've already learned everything they need to know from the data and they've profited off that data. So I think that this didn't go far enough, but I still think it's a win in some ways.
TikTok is under investigation by the FTC over data practices and could face a lawsuit. In this investigation, the FTC, or Federal Trade Commission for those not from the US, has been looking into whether TikTok violated a portion of federal law that prohibits unfair and deceptive business practices by denying that individuals in China had access to user data. The agency is also scrutinizing the company over potential violations of the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which requires kid-oriented apps and websites to get parents' consent before collecting personal information of the children under 13. The agency is nearing the conclusion of the investigation and could settle with TikTok in the coming weeks, but there's not a deadline for an agreement. I guess next, let's look at like Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat and everybody else. Why pick on just one of them? Our next story says President Biden is now posting into the Fediverse. So the official U.S. President Threads account, currently helmed by President Joe Biden, has begun using Meta's ActivityPub integration, making Biden the first sitting U.S. president to post on the decentralized networking protocol. If you want to follow the president's post but don't want to leave Mastodon, you can follow at POTUS at threads.net. That's POTUS, President of the United States, for those who are not familiar with that term. Biden may not be able to see replies and follows as they pour in from the Fediverse, and with some servers blocking connections to Meta, not everyone there will be able to see his posts, as those features weren't part of Threads integration when it opened up beta testing last month. But his posts are available, and he'll see likes coming in. So far, only Biden's official POTUS account appears to have toggled Threads Fediverse integration on. Neither Dr. Jill Biden nor Vice President Kamala Harris have showed up in a search, and none of them appear to have joined Blue Sky yet, a competing decentralized social network running on its own AT protocol that recently opened general signups. Whatever. I think it's a start. I think it's cool. I think it's interesting that they haven't joined Blue Sky. I guess I kind of wish they had, for many reasons. I wish they had opened their own server because, you know, I think that would really help Meta users be like, oh, let me go turn on ActivityPub to go follow the president. And, you know, I don't know. I just, for a lot of reasons, I think I would have preferred to see that, but I don't have any strong opinions on this, to be honest. I think it's good overall, but I wish he had made a server. That's all I got.
Yeah, I don't have much more to add outside of there's actually a more complete list of people who turned on this integration that I saw in Slashdot, and it included like a lot of the MKBHD team and just a lot of other more famous people who just randomly turned this on. And so there is a more complete list somewhere that you can find online of like other people you can follow. So it's not just this one account. There's quite a few people who've enabled this. Bad news for anonymous crypto transactions people. For people who are really wanting to contribute massive sums to the Surveillance Report podcast via Monero, this is bad news for you. Because under the new rules, anonymous cash payments over 3,000 euros will be banned in commercial transactions, and cash payments over 10,000 euros will be completely banned in business transactions. The European Parliament's ban on anonymous crypto transactions applies specifically to hosted or custodial crypto wallets offered by third-party service providers, such as centralized exchanges. And that's an important nuance. So, in theory, based on my understanding, if you wanted to contribute, in theory, 4,000 euros to this podcast, which I don't think you should probably do unless you really, really want to and you have the money to spend, it sounds like you can still do that if you have your own crypto wallet that has your own money in it and the other person has their own money. They're just banning this from like businesses that are holding your keys. Like if you're going through an exchange, like something like Coinbase, let's assume Coinbase supported Monero, which it doesn't, you wouldn't be able to transact a certain amount. So that's my understanding of it. But I should probably look more into this. And if this concerns any of you, you should definitely look more into it.
Okay, this story is an update. DeSantis, who is the governor of Florida, has signed a bill requiring parental consent for kids under 16 to hold social media accounts. So the bill requires that social media platforms prevent kids under 14 from creating accounts entirely and delete existing ones. It also requires parent or guardian consent for 14 and 15-year-olds to create or maintain accounts, and mandates that platforms delete social media accounts and personal information for this age group at the teen or parent's requests. Companies that fail to promptly delete accounts can be sued on behalf of those kids and may owe them up to $10,000 each. A knowing or reckless violation could also be considered an unfair or deceptive trade practice, subject up to $50,000 in civil penalties per violation. The bill also requires many commercial apps and websites to verify their users' ages, something that introduces a host of privacy concerns. But it does require websites to give users the option of, quote, anonymous age verification, which isn't really anonymous, it's just having a third party do it. The requirement kicks in when a site contains, quote, a substantial portion of material harmful to minors, unquote, which is defined as more than a third of content on a site, which would clearly target porn sites in particular. Such sites must ensure that users are 18 or older, though new sites are exempt from the requirement. The legislation is set to take effect on January 1st. The article goes on to point out that other states are doing stuff like this. Last year, Utah's governor signed into law two bills that require kids under 18 to get parental consent to use social media and would give parents access to kids' posts and messages. Soon after, Arkansas's governor approved a bill similarly requiring parental consent for minors to open accounts. A leading proposal in the U.S. Senate, the Kids Online Safety Act, which we are not fans of. I think Jonah and I think Techlore have both done videos about that. That recently passed the threshold of support needed to clear the chamber once scheduled for a vote. Another proposal in the Senate, Protecting Kids on Social Media Act, would require parental consent for kids under 18 to use social media. One expert that they interviewed compared the addictive features of social media to drinking alcohol and said kids are not yet equipped to moderate themselves. I know a lot of adults who are not yet equipped to moderate themselves. Unlike an adult who can make an adult decision, say, I drank too much last night, I need to drink less, or stop drinking altogether, a child in their brain development doesn't have the ability to know that they're being sucked into these addictive technologies and to see the harm and step away from it. And because of that, we have to step in for them. This is not a shot at Henry. I'm not going to make this super political, because Lord knows we got plenty political enough last time. But I'm a little concerned when I posted this story on my newsfeed and people were like, oh, I'm in favor of this. This is a good thing. No, no, this is not. Like, I understand if what you mean is social media has problems, it is bad for kids, and we need to rein it in. Because I agree with you. There is a plethora of evidence that correlates social media usage and, you know, depression, anxiety, self-esteem issues, like all these issues. Social media is harmful. I'm not arguing that for a second. I wouldn't want the government telling me how to parent my kids. That's between me and my kids to have that conversation where they trust me enough and I trust them enough. Like, okay, you're ready for the internet. I don't know. I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan. On the topic of age verification laws, this is just kind of a signal boost. According to 404, Kansas is about to pass the most extreme age verification law yet. It will make sites with more than 25% adult content liable to heavy fines if they don't verify visitors. It also calls being gay sexual conduct, which critics say could set up the state for more censorship of LGBT plus citizens. And if sites don't comply, they could be fined up to $10,000 for each violation, and parents could sue for damages of at least $50,000. It's just, it's the age verification of this stuff. And I mean, it's the censorship too, for the record, but as a privacy podcast, what we're focusing on is the age verification stuff. And it's the fact that these things are so loosely defined. You know, these laws are always ostensibly about like protecting the children from porn and stuff like that. All right, let's move over to Europe. Apple, Google, and Meta are facing their first formal investigations under the new Digital Markets Act. So Apple and Google's rules on steering in Google Play and its approach to self-preferencing and search results are in the frame. For Apple, the EU is also looking at its rules on the App Store and the design of choice screens for alternatives to Safari. Meta's pay or consent model will be scrutinized by the commission as well. In total, five investigations were announced less than 3 weeks since the compliance deadline. Yeah, less than 3 weeks since the compliance deadline kicked in for the companies earlier this month. Confirmed violations of the DMA can result in up to 10% of global annual turnover, or even 20% for repeat offenses, which I think is more than usual, so it's good to see that we're getting some teeth on some of this stuff. The EU will have up to 12 months to conclude the investigations per recommended timeframes. A preliminary report can be produced within 6 months, although senior commission officials noted that the probes may conclude sooner or could take longer than those guidelines. So we may be in for the long haul here, but hopefully we will see something. WorldCoin was hit with another ban in Europe, citing risks to kids. Portugal was just one of two European countries left where WorldCoin was still operating in its proprietary eyeball scanning orbs after Spain's ban. This leaves Germany as the only market where it's currently available to harvest biometrics in Europe as privacy watchdogs take urgent action to respond to local concerns. Portugal's Data Protection Authority said it issued the 3-month ban on WorldCoin's local ops after receiving complaints WorldCoin had scanned children's eyeballs. Other complaints cited in its press release announcing the suspension, which it notes was issued Monday, also mirrored Spain's concerns, including insufficient information being provided to users about the processing of their sensitive biometric data and the inability of users to delete their data or revoke consent to processing. That's all we got on that one. Okay, and our last political story. The German government published a law to guarantee the right to encryption. So this comes from TUDA. They said the Federal Ministry for Digital and Transport Affairs has published a draft bill that will require email, messenger, and other cloud providers to use strong end-to-end encryption. The new law sets a standard. People should be able to use end-to-end encryption, quote, wherever it is technically possible, unquote. While the bill is still a draft and has not yet passed the German parliament, there is reason to celebrate. For once, politicians want to strengthen encryption and not undermine it. Yet, the fight is not over. Now we must make our voice heard so the bill actually gets passed as planned in April of 2025. So, yes, if you are a German citizen, be sure to read this article, find the name of the law. I'm sorry I didn't note that. And call your politicians and say, yo, this guy, pass this guy. Call him every day. Okay, with that, we'll move into our free and open source news. So we'll start off with the Linux Foundation launching Valkey as a Redis fork. Okay, I'm probably going to screw this up. Please give me some grace here. There's a software called Redis that I think is kind of sort of like a database thing. I know it's used in Mastodon. I think there's a scheduling script for my news articles that somebody wrote for me that uses Redis. I know it's very popular. I'll be honest, I don't know totally what it does. It's a little bit above my level, but I know it's really popular and it's used for a lot of services. A couple weeks ago, or last week, I think, Redis changed their software license so that now it's not really open source. Open source is, for those just joining us, it is a highly contentious phrase, because in order for something to be truly quote-unquote open source, it has to meet certain requirements in terms of the licensing. Can you fork it? Do you have to pay to fork it? Can you redistribute it? Things like that. So Redis has basically gone source available. You can still see the source code and verify it, but if you change it in any way, you're not supposed to redistribute it. For a lot of people, I don't think this matters. Like me, I have no intention of ever forking it. I have no intention of distributing it. But understandably, I think there are a lot of people who, with any popular software, say, I think this could be better. I want to change this and I want to, you know, make it work on my Linux distro or my project or whatever. And now they can't do that. So I'm not trying to brush it off. I'm just saying for the average user, this probably wasn't a big deal, but there are definitely cases where this is a big deal. So in response to that, the Linux Foundation went public today with their intent to fork Valkey as an open source alternative to the Redis in-memory store. Due to the Redis licensing change, Valkey is forking from Redis 7.2.4, which is the most recent one before that license change, and will maintain a BSD 3 clause license. Google, AWS, Oracle, and others are helping form this new project. So, the article mentions there's other forks, but because these big companies are involved, this will probably rise to the top and become the dominant one. Being that I'm not a FOSS expert, that's kind of all I have to say on that one.
So our next FOSS story, empowering choice. Firefox partners with Quant for a better web. And for those who don't know, Quant is, I believe, a French-based privacy search engine. And so they put your needs first while protecting your personal data. That's their marketing. So Quant helps your search results remain unbiased and comprehensive. That's more of their marketing. But I'm just giving you guys understanding of what Quant is, because if I wasn't in the position I'm in, I wouldn't even have heard of Quant. But just like Firefox, they're committed to protecting your privacy and preserving the decentralized nature of the web, where people have control over their online experiences. So it's kind of unclear what this partnership is. From my understanding, it sounds like they're going to offer Quant as a default option in Firefox, but I don't think that it means it's going to be the default search engine, if that makes sense. Like, if you install Firefox, I don't think Quant's going to be the default. It just sounds like you're going to now have the option. But it's my loose understanding.
Okay, this next one is real quick, and it's good news. NT Auth is now available on desktop. So the NT Authenticator, you will need to create an account, of course, because it will need a way to sync. But beyond that, yeah, it's available on Linux, Mac, and Windows. This is a Mastodon post for audio listeners. They didn't really make like a big blog announcement. Cool stuff. I should probably mention that on my website now that I think about it.
Next up, Bitwarden Passkeys for iOS now in beta. Join today. So Bitwarden is an open source password manager we really like back here. It's available via TestFlight, and the link to join is in the Bitwarden forums, and Android is coming soon. This might be the first time ever that Proton actually beat someone to the punch. And actually, Jonah and I talked about this on our live stream last week, but we were talking about how we think the reason why Proton Pass is developing so quickly is because it seems like it's mostly just the simple login team that's working in Proton Pass, and they're doing a great job with it. So good job, Proton Pass. I think that like it's going super well over there. I also heard recently that Bitwarden is going through like a major UI redesign, and they're also getting like native clients as well. So it's not, I think, like Electron apps or whatever they're doing right now. So I don't know. I'm excited for Bitwarden.
Ubuntu Linux LTS will now get up to 12 years of support. So this is for Ubuntu Pro subscribers, which I think is technically free, so you may as well. It will now provide security maintenance and support for an impressive 12 years, extending the previous 10-year commitment. This will start with Ubuntu 14.04 LTS and will benefit both enterprises and individual users who rely on the stability and security of Ubuntu for their critical systems. By default, Ubuntu LTS releases receive 5 years of standard security maintenance. However, with Pro, this expanded to 10 years for both main and universe repositories, offering access to a broader range of secure open source software.
Some good news. So German state is moving 30,000 PCs to LibreOffice. So this is following a successful pilot project, which I actually believe we might have covered like years ago when they launched this. It sounds so familiar. So I don't know if it was a similar story or if it was the same story. And this is technically a follow-up. It's been so long. But the Northern German federal state of, I'm really sorry, guys, but I'm going to do it so everyone could laugh at me who speaks German. Schleswig-Holstein has decided to move.
I bet that was actually pretty close.
Maybe it was. I
like that you got the W right. The W is a V. I was like, he's not going to get that. So
when I flew to Germany for the Nextcloud conference, the first thing I said was when I left the plane, I was asking about something to the pilot, not the pilot, the airplane attendant about Brandenburg. That's how I said
Brandenburg.
Yeah, and then that's what she said. But also there was another word I said with the whole VW thing. And yeah. She responded to me correcting it, and I go, oh. Either way, but they've decided to move from Microsoft Windows and Microsoft Office to Linux and LibreOffice. For those who don't know, those are both open source tools. LibreOffice is an open source alternative to Microsoft Office and other free and open source software on the 30,000 PCs used in the local government. This was motivated mostly by GDPR compliance and data sovereignty, but also for money-saving reasons. And I think that just makes a lot of sense. It's something we've talked about back here, which is when something's publicly funded, you would think that it could be publicly transparent as well. Like, people should be able to see the software that the government's using and where your tax money's going towards, but also it saves money for the government and it gives them more control of what they're doing when they're using open source software. So it's kind of cool to see this, and hopefully it's successful. So that way other countries can take lead as well.
And this last one is quick. The Fedora Linux 40 beta is out. They are planning to release it sometime in April. Just again, some quick notes that are relevant to the podcast. PyTorch is a popular open source machine learning framework that will be included. Fedora IoT now uses OSTRI native containers or bootable containers. And the KDE desktop now ships with Plasma 6. 40 Workstation also brings us GNOME 46 and Podman 5 for container management. So cool stuff. If you want to help beta test that for the rest of the suckers like me who rely on stable, it would be appreciated. But for the rest of you suckers like me, stable is on the way, probably not too far after. So good job, Fedora. They are always killing it. I know that's like their whole thing is the rolling release, but still. It's cool to see them always moving forward. Let's go ahead and launch into Misfits. So this first story, a backdoor has been found in a widely used Linux utility that breaks encrypted SSH connections. Researchers have found a malicious backdoor in a compression tool that made its way into widely used Linux distros, including those from Red Hat and Debian. The utility, known as XZUtils, introduced the malicious code in versions 5.6.0 and 5.6.1, according to Andres Freund. There are no known reports of those versions being incorporated into any production releases for major Linux distros, but both Red Hat and Debian reported that recently published beta releases used at least one of the backdoored versions, specifically in Fedora Rawhide and Debian testing, unstable and experimental distributions. A stable release of Arch is also affected, however, that distro is not used in production systems. Because the backdoor was discovered before the malicious versions of XZUtils were added to production versions of Linux, quote, it's not really affecting anyone in the real world, unquote. But that's only because it was discovered early due to bad actor sloppiness. Had it not been discovered, it would have been catastrophic to the world, unquote. So I do want to emphasize that. This never made it into production. Nobody has been compromised. But that was kind of luck. Like, if nobody had caught this, this would have been really bad. And it's also worth noting, before I jump in a little bit more, this is one of the reasons that we are fans of source available stuff, is how many things like this could have been introduced in proprietary software that simply nobody's found because they can't look at the source code and go, hey, that's weird. There's a whole timeline here that's really hard to explain. This goes back years. So basically what happened is there was a one or two developers that kind of started being active in the community. You know, everybody starts somewhere. That's not suspicious, but they just kind of showed up and started being active in the community and kind of worked on a number of different repos. And eventually they worked their way into this XZUtils, basically got themselves to a point where they were a trusted person and they seemed to be reliable. Like, they've been around for a while. This wasn't a stranger who just showed up 6 months ago. Like, they've been around for years. They worked themselves into a trusted position and then tried to sneak in this like genuine backdoor. And I want to point out, this is a backdoor. This is a real backdoor. I know that a lot of people, and I'm sorry, I know some of you guys get mad when we like focus on the 10 people who caused trouble instead of the 9,000 of you guys that are totally chill and sane, but there's always those alarmists out there who are like, oh my God, it's got telemetry, it's spyware. Oh my God, it's got a bug, it's a backdoor. Like, they just assume malice in everything. And 99% of the time, that's not the case. 99% of the time, it's, we just want to understand how users are using the software. We want, you know, there was a bug that was found. And I understand if you're against telemetry, well, to an extent. I understand if you're against that. That's not what I'm talking about. My point is, it's not malicious. This one's actually malicious. This is what a real backdoor looks like. You know, like Henry and I went on a rant a couple of weeks ago or a couple months ago about Pegasus. And again, telemetry, people are, every connection is spyware. Well, it undermines actual spyware like Pegasus. Same thing here. This is an actual backdoor. This is what a backdoor really looks like. This was maliciously inserted after years of planning, and the whole purpose was to intentionally break connections and steal data from users. There's a lot more detail in the article. Again, this went back literal years, so there's a lot to this story. I think if I understood the article correctly, it actually seems like it would have only impacted certain users and certain conditions. So this might even be, this is just me speculating, I could be wrong here, please listen to the experts instead of me. This might be like a nation state attempt at cyber espionage of certain people or certain organizations. I'm not sure, but yeah, this was an actual malicious backdoor. And thank God for Andres Freund and finding this early. You're a freaking hero. Somebody on Mastodon, I forget who, they basically said, like, everyone owes this guy a beer.
All right, so India rescues 250 citizens enslaved by Cambodian cybercrime gang. So this is a little bit of a signal boost here from Nate. So the Indian government says it rescued and repatriated 250 citizens who sought jobs in Cambodia, only to be forced into conducting cybercrime. The government explains that these people were tricked into believing that lucrative job opportunities were waiting for them in the Southeast Asian nation, yet they were forced into becoming cyber criminals once they arrived there. After several nationals informed India's embassy in Cambodia of their dire situation, the country worked with the Cambodian authorities to locate and bring them back. However, India Today reports that there are at least 5,000 more held captive in Cambodia and forced to launch scams that have generated nearly $60 million in the last 6 months. One of the rescued scammers reports that he had come to Cambodia to fill out a data entry job, but was instead forced to be living in horrid conditions while carrying out scams coordinated by a team of Chinese and Malaysian scammers. The person termed Cyberslave reports that they were told to recreate fake social media profiles used for defrauding fellow Indians. Their overseers assigned daily financial quotas and enforced them with physical violence and isolation on those who failed to meet them. Of course, the government only took action when a senior employee got swindled and reported the losses. So we're including a link to a podcast episode that I believe that Nate listened to and highly recommends to talk about this exact type of situation, which also includes ways that you can help be a part of the solution.
So the Moon malware is actually an existing known malware. This is a new variant that has been spotted infecting thousands of outdated small office and home office routers and IoT devices in 88 countries. The malware's latest campaign has been seen infecting nearly 7,000 devices in 1 week, with Black Lotus Labs saying they primarily targeted Asus routers. The researchers did not specify the exact method used to breach the routers, but given that the targeted device models are end of life, it is likely that the attackers leverage known vulnerabilities in the firmware. The attackers may also brute force admin passwords or test default and weak credentials. So, I have a section on the New Oil's website. If you go to our homepage, thenewoil.org, and you scroll down, there's a quick start guide for home networks. It's kind of got all the basics, you know, change your default password, make sure you're getting updates, stuff like that. So yeah, I mean, there you go. Change your default password, change the default port, if you're comfortable doing that. Make sure you're getting updates. If it's no longer getting updates, I personally am a huge fan of get updates, especially something like a router that is constantly exposed to the internet. Activate firewalls. A lot of devices, I think, are now compatible with like DDWRT, OpenWRT, Tomato, so you can actually extend the life of that device. So yeah, definitely look into these kind of things. They can be a great way to help yourself. Over 15 free VPN apps on Google Play were found using a malicious software development kit that turned Android devices into unwitting residential proxies likely used for cybercrime and shopping bots. A lot of proxies this week. So I mentioned VPNs earlier in the show. This is just a reminder. Stick with the reputable ones. IRL fakes, where people pay for an AI-generated porn of normal people. So this comes from 404. There is a Telegram user who advertises their services on Twitter and will create an AI-generated pornographic image of anyone in the world for as little as $10 if users send them pictures of that person. Like many other Telegram communities and users producing non-consensual AI-generated sexual images, this user creates fake nude images of celebrities, including images of minors in swimsuits, but is particularly notable because it plainly and openly shows one of the most severe harms of generative AI tools, easily creating non-consensual pornography of ordinary people. In one of the chat rooms in this Telegram channel, titled IRL Fakes, the person who creates the images posts real photos of people seemingly taken from their social media profiles alongside their AI-generated porn. It appears the Telegram user does this both to prove their ability to offer this service to potential customers and to humiliate the women being targeted. Honestly, that sums up most of the article, in my opinion. Like, this really shatters the nothing to hide myth. It's really easy for people to say, you know, oh, I'm not famous, no one would target me. But again, that's a situation that I think mostly women, but I think a lot of people have been in. Probably some guys too, but I'd imagine it's mostly women, have been in these situations where they're like, oh yes, this could actually happen to me. And I think that would make them uncomfortable. And we've covered, I'm pretty sure we've covered, if we haven't covered them, I've seen them for sure. We've covered stories in the past where people have this stuff. It shows up in search engines. When you look up their name, they send it to friends and social circles. Cause sometimes it's not a stranger on the internet doing this. Sometimes it's that guy, you know, who won't take no for an answer. Like, this stuff can spiral out of control real fast, and it's the internet. Once it's out there, it's hard to take back. So yeah, this is like a textbook case for why privacy matters and not just for famous people. iOS sysadmin pleads guilty to 33-year identity theft of former coworker. This guy, I normally try to wait till the end to inject opinion, but this guy is objectively got to be one of the worst human beings on the planet. This is a heartbreaking story. So according to the documents, Matthew David Kierens maliciously worked with authorities, supplying them with forged documents that would ultimately see his victim jailed and admitted to a mental hospital for nearly a year and a half. Kierens first met his victim, who ran away from home at 16, about 1988, while working at a hot dog stand in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Roughly 2 years later, in 1990, Kierens is said to have assumed the victim's identity, quote, in every aspect of his life, unquote, purchasing all manner of forged documents, including a birth certificate, social security number, and I-9 form, all of which he later used to secure employment at an Iowa hospital in 2013 as a remote sysadmin. And the article goes on to describe various loans, jobs, even relationships that Kierens went on to have using the victim's identity, which... I guess at that point, when you're in that deep, you just have to go with it. But I find the relationship one especially weird. Like, I think they even said this dude got married, maybe even had kids. Like, yeah, okay. Picking back up from the article. If the awfulness wasn't already evident enough here, the true malice behind Kieran's actions became clear in 2019 when the then homeless victim discovered that the huge debt taken in his name, which amounted to around $130,000 at the time. He went to his local LA bank to clear things up. Given the large sums in the account, the victim was asked a series of security questions, which of course he failed to answer correctly because he didn't create them. That prompted the bank teller dealing with the victim to alert the LAPD, who arrested him after Kierens faxed a series of forged documents to local police, quote-unquote, proving that he was the real person. This is all despite the real victim presenting a genuine social security card and California state ID. To cap it off, the victim was arrested not under his own name, but under Kieran's instead. The worst part, the victim was held in county jail for 428 days total, and after a California judge deemed him mentally unfit to stand trial, he pleaded no contest to the two felony charges against him. He was sent to a mental hospital for a total of 147 days and medicated with psychotropic drugs. Real quick, for those who don't know, no contest... I'm not even sure how this is legally a thing, but it basically means I'm not admitting guilt, but I will go ahead and do the consequences. I think it's so that it doesn't technically show up on your criminal record, but you still do the time. It's weird. From then on, the judge also ordered him to only use his quote-unquote true name, Matthew Kierens, going forward. Throughout the ordeal, the real Kierens, earning a healthy salary through his work-from-home sysadmin gig, was in regular contact with authorities requesting updates to the victim's criminal case. In numerous messages sent between him and authorities, Kierens was seen going along with the realities of the case, and at the time the victim's mental fitness was questioned, he implied there was a possibility the victim may regain that fitness. Fucking garbage human being. The victim was released from both hospital and jail in 2021, was again homeless, and spent more than 2 years filing various reports to convince any authority that would listen that he was, in fact, the victim of identity fraud. His luck turned around on January 13th of 2023 when, after discovering where Kieran's worked, he informed the hospital about the situation. The hospital was his employer, reminder, which then engaged a senior detective in the local police force. That detective managed to unravel Kieran's 33-year scheme over a course of several months, in part using DNA tests to definitively prove Kierens wasn't the son of an elderly man in Kentucky, as he had previously claimed. During a series of interviews with the detective, Kierens initially continued to falsely present as the victim until the DNA evidence was presented to him, at which point he said, quote, my life is over, and, quote, everything is gone. Kierens now faces a potential maximum sentence of 32 years in prison with a minimum of 2 years. Should be a minimum of 32 years. He'll also have to pay $1.25 million in fines and serve 5 years of supervised release after his sentence. So, needless to say, this is an incredibly extreme story. But I think, oh my God, this story is just insane. And it kind of, like, bare minimum here is like freezing your credit and stuff like that. And I think, again, this is a really extreme story. I don't think everybody necessarily needs to have this level of paranoia. But it just kind of goes to show you, like, how crazy identity theft can get on the extreme end. I don't know. Yeah, this was just a wild story.
Well, that's it for the week. Again, Facebook is sharing your DMs with other companies. There's a new Linux backdoor, so make sure you're in the loop on all of that. Chase wants to track your spending, and there are some insane misfits this week, as well as just a lot more. It's been a pretty crazy 2 weeks, so thank you all for the patience as we try to wrap this up. And again, we just can't be doing this without people who are supporting our work, and Patreon's a great way to do that. In fact, that's the best way to do it, at patreon.com/surveillancepod. You also get really cool benefits, like you get to join our Q&A, and also you get exclusive access to some like extra stuff in these episodes that you wouldn't otherwise catch in the regular upload. If you don't like Patreon, again, you always have LiberPay and you have Monero as well. And the final thing, just we want to thank you for being here. We want to thank you for listening to this and keeping yourself educated. In addition to that, keeping other people around you educated, sharing these stories, and just being involved in any way, shape, or form. Just thank you for being here, and we'll see you next time.